The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, it's 2010. We've done the wrap-up from 2009. What are we looking at as the key things that we need to be watching this year?
Frankly, Kevin, it's difficult to be concise when you look at the categories which are so important. The economic concerns, the political concerns, the geopolitical concerns, and of course, as we've noted in past weeks, the political and the geopolitical become even more important in 2010 than they have been in 2007, 8, and 9. And that's where we're at in the evolution of this crisis. Now we have policies that are being offered up as a solution to both the financial and economic problems. And now we get to test whether or not they work. If they don't work, the question is, who do we blame? So that really is where we find ourselves. So we'll dive in and talk about several of the economic concerns we have for 2010.
Well, David, I know that one of the main concerns that you had as we were going into the Christmas holiday was the bond crisis. That's why we went back and talked about, you know, the big bond bust. Is that still on your radar?
Well, for 2010, that's probably the defining question if you're talking about economics and money flow, because what you have, Kevin, is an unbelievable amount of money that has to exchange hands. So who wants the paper? Who wants the Treasury bills, bonds, and notes? And more importantly, Kevin, at what price?
Well, what kind of money are we talking about here?
Well, over the next 2 years, you've got $2.5 trillion that the government has to roll over. So this is existing debt, which is coming due, and they need to, exactly as we described, roll it over into the next cycle. Is it roll it over into threes, fives, sevens, tens, thirties, in terms of an extension of that debt?
Now, when you say roll over, that means we have to have a buyer to be able to continue in this debt process.
Well, exactly. We're just extending the terms of existing debt. That does not count, Kevin. That does not count the $2 trillion in new debt to finance this year. The official estimates are quite a bit lower than that. The problem I have with the official estimates on the new debt coming due in 2010 is that there's an underlying assumption that GDP will be growing somewhere between 2.5% and 3%, and they seem to be ignoring the decline in tax revenues. That seems to be completely overlooked. So, Kevin, if you think about the expected deficit, budget deficit, but they're not counting the lack of income coming in, and they are actually going to end up spending more than they think they're going to spend, I think you find yourself at a minimum of $2 trillion in new debt to be financed in 2010 on top of the two-year goal of rolling over $2.5 trillion.
Well, here's my question, though, David. Don't interest rates have to rise to entice people to go in and pay for that debt or to buy that debt? I mean, who's going to come in? Is it going to be the Europeans, the Chinese? Where does that go?
Well, that's one of the points we made a few weeks ago, Kevin, is that 2009, we actually had net liquidations of U.S. treasuries for the first time in many, many years. And so just when we need basically a doubling of the appetite for government debt, we actually have people stepping away and saying, I'm not interested to the degree that I was before. Now, here's one of the significant issues, Kevin, to be looked at in 2010. There's already $2.2 trillion of paper on the Fed balance sheet. Now, the $2.2 trillion on the Fed balance sheet is something that they're comfortable with, but they realize they can't expand infinitely. And so there's been some discussion about reducing the amount of paper on the Fed balance sheet. Now, the question is, how do you do that without roiling the interest rate market? Because if you were to bring $500 billion to the bond market, just lighten the balance sheet a bit by $500 billion, guess what you see? You've got bond yields going up 150 to 200 basis points, and the price of bonds dropping significantly.
Well, and let's face it, everybody's watching that bond market. Whatever they do next, it's almost like there's thin ice right now. Is it going to go down? Is it going to go up?
Right. The folks at the CFR, that is the Council on Foreign Relations, have suggested something like Blackpool trading of treasuries.
Okay, now, what's Blackpool trading?
Okay, well, if you look at the stock market has these very opaque structures, which are very new to the market, just the last few years, You used to be able to, as a market maker in Wall Street, if you owned a seat on the New York Stock Exchange, you could see the trades coming in, a request to liquidate block trades and a request to purchase block trades. You're responsible for marrying up those trades. Liquidation of 10,000 shares here, purchase of 10,000 shares there. You marry the buyer and the seller. You know both parties.
Right.
The black pool trading, you don't know who's in the marketplace and you don't know what quantities are being brought to the market. Hmm. And the suggestion here is that the treasury market is so immense at this point and the constraints, the needs are so great in terms of net liquidations, we don't want the public to know how much debt is being liquidated because we don't want there to be an impact into that market.
Because it would affect the interest rates and therefore the bond market as far as the pricing of those bonds.
And we already have Morgan Stanley analysts looking at long-term interest rates jumping from currently less than 5% to 7.5% to 8% by the end of the year.
So what kind of impact is that on the bond market, the long bond market? What kind of drop would that precipitate in the principal value of those bonds?
A 30% to 40% drop in the market value of those bonds. So, you know, you're looking at treasury yields significantly higher. Here's what gets interesting and what we would propose as kind of a thought experiment. If you go back to the ideas we discussed this last year, the SDRs, the IMF has long been using these things called
special drawing rights.
Exactly. Yeah. Special drawing rights. And basically what the IMF could do in cooperation with sort of a black pool trade of treasuries is this. They create a structure in which you can exchange your treasuries for a basket of currencies, a certificate that represents a basket of currencies. So you immediately move from a treasury holding into an SDR, which is a four-currency basket, a paper that represents a four-currency basket. And what that would do is allow for there to be a diminution of importance of the U.S. Treasury and the U.S. dollar on the world scene. And it would allow for an exit strategy from dollars without impacting the market negatively. And people are particularly concerned about this in Europe because if the dollar should take a nosedive, guess what? Relatively speaking, the euro appreciates that much more. Even though on its own merits, I think it's incredibly weak, relative to the dollar, it can increase and thus bludgeon their exports.
It's hard enough for them to sell right now with the decrease in the value of the dollar that we've already seen. You know, let's face it, European items are very, very expensive.
Right. That's why I think you might see a proposal come from the IMF. You know, they already put in $250 billion into STRs this last year. For them to quadruple or quintuple that market, add another $1 trillion into the SDR scheme, I think is actually quite realistic.
Okay, well, this brings another question. With all this deleveraging and this debt problem as far as not being able to borrow money as a country, as a corporation, as a state, we've seen commodities booming as if there's going to be inflation. I mean, with this deleveraging, Bert Doman has already come out and said, you know, he really believes that you're going to have pressure on the downside of all the pricing of things until the debt's taken care of. What's your thought on that?
Well, we're going to spend some time talking a little bit about China in a few minutes, but one of the main drivers of commodities in 2009 was Chinese consumption. Mm-hmm. And you had the government spend, with bank lending and government spending, $1 trillion in 2009 to build infrastructure.
Just on their own infrastructure.
Now, what does infrastructure need? Infrastructure needs base commodities, base materials.
Copper, concrete. Yeah.
Exactly, steel. But actually what they've done is they've created a huge glut in their own system, backup, if you will, of huge inventories in almost all of these base commodities. And they're assuming that they're going to be able to continue the process they put into place in 2009.
Well, now we've seen gold rise based on these commodity prices rising, but is it also monetary? I mean, will gold diverge from the other commodities if they come down?
And I think that's an excellent point, Kevin. I think that's exactly what we will see, is a divergence between the general commodities market and gold, wherein your base commodities and industrial materials end up getting pressured lower by a slowdown in China. You see export countries like Canada and Australia who begin to have significant pressure put on them because there's a slowdown in business and a slowdown in consumption from China.
Mm-hmm.
Orders drop significantly. At the same time, gold and silver take on a greater role as a currency substitute, both for large investors and informed institutions. And so I think we'll see a significant divergence between gold and silver in 2010 from other commodities. And in this scenario, frankly, Kevin, if we saw the dollar rise, I think you could still see gold and silver rise. But of course, if the dollar were to continue falling, you would see it impact gold positively that much the more.
Well, how does this affect the risk appetite right now that we've seen in the second part of this last year? I mean, with the emerging markets rising and junk bonds, I mean, what's that appetite going to do when it gets bitten again?
This is a great question, Kevin, because if you're thinking about economic concerns, just remember that 2008 and the early part of 2009 were utterly catastrophic, and yet the risk appetite returned without a second thought for what had just happened.
That was amazing. I mean, people burned on the stove, reaching back up and possibly burning themselves again.
Exactly. So right now, Kevin, we have bullish consensus. It hasn't been this high, and the bearish crowd hasn't been so small since the spring and summer of 1987. So, I mean, if you're looking at sort of how people are feeling, the quote-unquote animal spirits in the marketplace...
It's time to play.
Absolutely. Yeah. People are back into emerging markets. The three top-performing areas in the economy, Kevin, in the markets this year were emerging markets, junk bonds, and commodities. Those were the big winners. You're looking at speculative money that went into micro markets for quick gains. And I think it should not be forgotten that bear market bottoms are marked. Bear market bottoms, when they finally are finished, are marked by total revulsion with the asset classes that were in favor as the hopes and dreams of wealth are dashed.
Yeah, so in other words, when you talk to somebody, instead of a shoeshine boy giving you stock advice, the shoeshine boy just laughs at you for ever owning a stock.
Exactly. Yeah, the sobering circumstances of insolvency, that becomes front and center, and people aren't even willing to entertain the idea of buying that asset class.
So we have two opposing forces that we're still talking about. We talked about it all last year. Inflation, if we're going to see these bubbles continue to grow, or deflation with all this deleveraging that's going on. I mean, will the liquidity created exceed the dollars destroyed in the context of deleveraging, David?
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Kevin, because there's been a massive amount of liquidity created, a massive amount of dollars and paper assets put into the system.
Trillions.
The question is, has that number, the total stock of dollars and liquidity and credit created, has it replaced the amount of money destroyed in the process of deleveraging between 2008 and 2009? And the reality is, it has not matched the dollars that have been destroyed. So you have not seen a massive amount of inflation. And here's where I think, you know, as we begin to talk about politics in a few minutes, Kevin, this is where you begin to see politics play a major part. You create the liquidity and you put it into the pipeline. Okay, that's the first step. The second step is for that liquidity to have some multiplication, which in fact is, as we'll note in a minute.
Isn't that something that you call velocity, as far as how many times a dollar changes hands in a given year?
Right. So the velocity of money, or the M1 money multiplier, that has utterly collapsed. As that returns, as the money multiplier increases, as the velocity of money increases, then the liquidity that you've put into the system gets multiplied 5, 10, 15 times.
And that's inflationary.
That's very inflationary. And the question at that point is this, Kevin. The question is, will Congress not pressure the Fed to do the right thing at the right time? Because they actually need to rein in the money supply. They actually need to diminish the money supply at that point and do so quickly. They need to tighten credit. They need to raise interest rates. And this is where the Fed, having become so politicized, is inherently inflationary. You can't get to that point where the money's been created. And we've watched that happen for over 12 months.
Right.
The liquidity's been created. Where's the inflation? It's very easy, Kevin. The money multiplier, velocity of money is still on its back. You don't see inflation because there's still this deleveraging which is occurring, and we're basically pouring money into a bucket full of holes. And the question is, if they actually patch the holes, will there be discretion at the top? Will there be the will to actually turn off the spigot? And we would argue no. The next thing, Kevin, I think to remember is that unemployment is a theme from 2009 that carries into 2010.
That plays into this tension as far as, you know, does consumption go up at this point, or are people still strapped due to the unemployment and the contraction?
Well, I think we can clearly say, Kevin, two things. Going back to what we were just discussing, liquidity and credit creation, to the extent that velocity of money and the M1 money multiplier is not increasing, if there's no credit, if there's no recovery in credit, there's no economic recovery.
Right.
Okay. But second to that, going back to unemployment, if there's no employment recovery, there's no economic recovery.
Well, how do we bring unemployment down? I mean, how long does it take to actually start reducing the unemployment rate to where it's reasonable again?
Well, this is what's fascinating, because in less than a year, we went from 7.2% to 10.2%. And then Paul Krugman just recently said it's going to take 300,000 jobs a month added to the rolls, and that will bring us down to 8% by 2020.
Oh, my. So we're talking about another decade before we get back down to 8% if we can add 300,000 new jobs per month for that entire time.
According to Krugman, that's correct. So it took us a year to go from 7.2 to 10.2, but it'll take us 10 years to go from 10 to 8. So this is a reality. Unemployment is going to be with us for a long time to come.
Well, how many people, actual bodies, do we have unemployed at this point?
Department of Labor puts the total at 31 million. We would suggest that U6 is definitely closer to a real-world number, which at 18% plus puts us somewhere between 54 and 60 million unemployed here in the United States.
But there is no economic recovery, is what you're saying at this point.
Well, again, until credit recovers, the economy won't recover. And until employment recovers, the economy won't recover.
Okay, so going back to the gold question, because I asked about the divergence of gold. Commodities could drop, unemployment could stay high, is what you're saying, and gold could still go up. I mean, where are we in this cycle of the gold bull market?
Well, I think we're in a cycle where the general public is starting to pay more and more attention because gold is quickly becoming viewed as a currency alternative.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so as a currency alternative, rather than bank deposits, people want gold. Rather than treasuries, people want gold. Rather than foreign currencies, people want gold. Because they realize that behind all of these paper promises, there's a whole host of people that they're finding to be unreliable, untrustworthy, and actually not that qualified to do what they are supposed to be doing.
But let's face it, Dave, it's still not the man on the street. I mean, what phase? We've talked about phases in a bull market before. What phase do you think we're in? One, two, or three? And explain what those phases are.
I think we're in the middle phase, and I think we're on the verge of moving into the third phase. Kevin, that's where you begin to see a parabolic rise in the price of gold. The final phase is where you see the man in the street come into the market.
The shoeshine boy, that's when he's buying gold.
Exactly. The first phase is definitely marked by a maverick or insider. That's the investor who's coming in the first phase. The second phase of any bull market, and particularly what we're talking about here is the gold and silver bull market, is marked by Wall Street. Wall Street takes their significant positions. 2009 probably marked the entree by the wealthiest in the world into the gold bull market, facilitated by your hedge funds and the managers, which we've mentioned in past shows. The third phase, I think, you know, we're between 24 and 36 months of entering into that final stage.
Which is the parabolic stage.
Correct. Yeah. And that, I think, Kevin, as we look at 2010, this is where the conversation needs to be held. This is where the strategy needs to be very well understood and crystallized in the mind of anyone who owns precious metals. What is a reasonable exit strategy?
Mm-hmm.
Not suggesting that it's employed in 2010, but begin to crystallize with great clarity what it looks like to have an exit strategy. Discuss that. Discuss that with your person at ICA. Discuss that with your broker. This is the value that we bring as an investment management company. We want to make sure that you see the end from the beginning. Where are we going tomorrow, and what should you be doing? Let's anticipate before we get there.
And just to restate the triangle, when you're talking about an exit strategy, Dave, remember with the triangle, one-third in precious metals for preservation and for just protection, a third in other investments, and then a third in cash. When you're talking about an exit strategy, what you're talking about are those investments that are beyond that third that a person's using to speculate basically on the gold market. Is that correct?
Well, not exactly, Kevin, because if you have a third in precious metals, and let's say that over the next 3 to 4 years we see the price appreciate to $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 an ounce.
Mm-hmm.
What you've basically done is just bloated your one-third allocation to gold. It may now represent 60 to 70% of your asset base.
And that's when it gets reduced during that exit strategy.
And it absolutely needs
back
to be reduced
third.
Back to a third. So again, it's a question of taking something off the table. It's a question of being prudent in the context of a rising market. It's a question of selling into strength and selling early. As Meyer Amschel used to say, I buy when there's blood in the streets and sell too soon. That's my recipe for wealth.
Okay, now speaking of real items, you know, in the past we've talked about owning real estate. If you own it without debt, it's like owning a real item. Similar to gold, it's just not as liquid. When does the real estate market actually start to recover, and is that something that's right now on the cusp of 2010?
No, that's a monster for 2010, Kevin, because you've got the mortgage-backed securities market, which has been monetized to the tune of $1.25 trillion in 2009. And the question is, can they stop the monetization? Because, again, if you're looking at the Fed balance sheet, if you're looking at all of these behind the scenes pockets of capital which are taking the excess treasuries off the market, the excess Fannie Mae paper off the market, the excess Freddie Mac paper off the market. If that paper was left to be in the market, do you know what would happen to the price of that paper?
It would go down.
It would go down and the interest rates would go up. So there is a motivation on the part of the Fed and the Treasury to continue monetization.
Okay, let's say I'm a private mortgage broker, okay, and I'm giving mortgages out at this point. What percentage do I represent in the market versus all these bailed out large government organizations like Fannie Mae and Freddie?
The private origination market is very slim, Kevin. For 2009, 96% of all mortgages were done through FHA.
So in other words, the government's basically funding all the mortgages, virtually.
96% Federal Housing Association was responsible for, and the problem, Kevin, is that 14% of those are already in default. 14% are in default. You can see, as plain as the nose on my face, the next bailout is FHA. So the monsters in the real estate market, unfortunately, Kevin, all begin with the letter F.
So basically what you have is a lot of F words, but they're three-letter acronyms.
Fannie Mae, yeah. Freddie Mac, and the Federal Housing Association. Those are the monsters in the real estate market. We'll see an outright nationalization of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and the question is to what degree will they have to bail out FHA? Because again, Kevin, if they're concerned about the economy recovering and that the man on the street feeling confident about loosening his purse strings, he has to feel good about his personal wealth. And that doesn't happen when his real estate, his home, is falling in value.
Well, and it doesn't happen if his dollars are going to zero as well. I mean, where do you see the dollar going at this point? Is it going to get crushed or is it going to be saved?
Let's talk about the dollar a little bit before we transition and talk about some of our political concerns, because the dollar is right on the cusp and it kind of sits the fence between our economic and our political concerns. Kevin, the reality is we have, since 2000-2001, seen a devolution of the dollar. And the question now is,
a devolution to what?
Well, from 120 to about 72, we've seen a minor bounce to 78 compared to the euro index. But we've seen a devolution of its role on the world scene. Hmm. We once were, and still are, the world's reserve currency. But over the last decade, very significantly, has been a change in sentiment. Everyone was happy with the way things were. People are not so happy with the way things are now, and they're looking for alternatives. Thus, as we were discussing earlier, have the SDR and that expanded use, you know, going from $250 billion to $1.25 trillion in 2010 would be our estimate, that the IMF really gets that cranked up.
Which is sort of an off-balance sheet way of owning currency. I mean, isn't that a form of international currency? You've got the dollar in there, the euro in there. What else is in there?
So the question is, do we see some sort of development where the euro and the dollar are some sort of duopoly? Or is the SDR and a four-currency solution, a four- or five-currency solution, more probable, where the dollar is just another fruit in the basket? What we saw with the SDRs in 2009 was that of total international reserves, it went from being under 1% of total international reserves to now being 5% of all international reserves. And, you know, so what role does it continue to play? Does it continue to increase as the total scope and import of the dollar decreases? And we think that that is a solid trend for 2010.
All right, David, we've discussed your economic concerns at this point for 2010, the things that we'll be looking at in the program as we proceed through the months. What are some of the political concerns? As you've said in the past, the financial morphs into the economic, which moves into the political, and then ultimately the geopolitical. What are your political concerns for 2010?
And just to clarify that again, Kevin, why do things move from the economic to the political? What's the connection there? The constituent parts of an economy are you and me and everyone around us. It's people. And when people feel a certain way, they vote a certain way. If they're happy, they vote one way. If they're sad, if they're upset, if they're angry, they vote another way. So politics is front and center in the context of economics being either grand and glorious or miserable.
So when in pain, you don't necessarily vote the best long-term approach. You try to take away the pain.
Well, in fact, Kevin, a study of the last 100 years, if GDP growth was in excess, greater than 3%, the incumbent always wins. Hmm. And if it was lower than 3%, in the last 100 years, there's never been a president that has won an election with GDP growth under 3%. Now, you tell me if the government is going to fudge the numbers and try to convince you and show you that GDP growth by the time we get to 2012 has been in excess of 3%.
That's an amazing statistic.
But here's the other thing, Kevin, for 2010 particularly. We've got the census this year, and that too will impact government numbers. You've got 10 questions, so it's a smaller query than the last time we had a census, but the main point of controversy is still there, and this is not a small issue. Robert Groves, the Bureau Director of the Census, and along with the President Administration, they've promised. They have promised. You've heard it. Read my lips. They have promised to not redraw any boundaries or districts.
All right. Now, explain what you mean by redrawing boundaries or districts, because isn't this one of the key political manipulations of a census?
Well, this is what can happen, is the number of state representatives is determined by the census. Mm-hmm. Okay. The legislature is directly impacted by the census. In addition to that, you've got individual states, the allocation from federal coffers, the distribution of federal money, which actually is your money and mm-hmm. my money that we gave to them. They're giving back to us, almost like a tax return. It was ours in the first place. But here's what happens. If you stick your hand up high enough, if there's enough of you that stick your hand up high enough and say, hey, wait a minute, our state has grown. It doesn't matter if they're legals or illegals. Guess what? You get a greater percentage of the $400 billion rebate coming back to states.
Well, and David, doesn't the census also affect the Electoral College, the way the vote actually plays out in the end?
That's right, Kevin. The Electoral College is probably the most important part of the census. It is impacted directly by the census. And, of course, the Oval Office is in turn determined by the Electoral College.
You know, something that they're probably also going to be needing to address, you know, unemployment still seems to be, we talked about it on the economic part of the program, but now from the political side, government policies right now are being set in motion to respond to unemployment. At least that's what we're being told. Will that have an effect by 2012?
The issue, though, Kevin, is that the job creation proposals are being politically directed back to those that voted for the current administration. The healthcare reform bill, virtually every solution proffered by the administration, it does a couple things. It grows the federal agencies, it adds significant numbers to an already long list of government employees, and it reinforces the trend of labor unions and big business.
Hmm.
Now, why? Because labor unions and big business are the biggest contributors.
It's almost like affecting the Electoral College, like we said before. At this point, you're basically giving the money to those who are going to vote for you next.
Right. And Kevin, it's interesting because there's more people in government that understand this from a bureaucratic, from a life skills survival standpoint, if you will, people who've dedicated themselves to being government parasites. Listen to this, Kevin. Bert Doman recently wrote that this administration has the least number of people with real business experience of any administration in the last 100 years. There's less than 8% of the total people in government who have any real-world business experience.
Less than 8% who've had to actually meet a payroll without going into debt.
No, that's right. All they have known is the parasitic life, that of a leech, that of a mosquito, that of a vampire, sucking the lifeblood out of a system. That's all they know, and they're used to it. They're comfortable with that as a successful model.
So is it time for businessmen to start opening up branches or liaison offices in Washington, D.C. and become bureaucrats?
I think, actually, Kevin, that's a brilliant idea. I don't know how many people will do it, but if you're in big business, you already have a branch office in Washington, D.C. because you know that the only way to survive and thrive is to have political contacts. I think this is, Kevin, where we can say the economic recovery of 2010 is alive and well. The economic recovery of 2010 is here. It's here. The question is, are you politically connected? Because if you're not, you're not going to see the economic recovery. However, if you are politically connected, you're seeing the recovery. You're the recipient of billions. You're the recipient of hundreds of millions, depending on what industry you're
in. But if you're a small or medium-sized business owner?
Not a chance. Not a chance. Because the real things that drive business haven't changed. And so again, Kevin, you go back to the idea that the most recent job summit, where they're going to try to spend $500 billion to create jobs, who was invited? Who was invited? It was the unions, it was healthcare, and it was big business. Your small business associations were not even invited. And yet, they are responsible. This is your, you know, less than 500 employees, your smaller businesses, not your Fortune 500.
The small businesses provide most of the jobs in the economy.
80%. Mm. 80%. So we're really not looking at solving the unemployment problem. What we're looking at doing is resolidifying our voting block and resolidifying our campaign contributions for 2010 and 2012, because we want to know who is funding our victorious effort in those 2 years.
All right, but the small businessmen and the medium-sized businessmen will be the ones taxed, will they not? I mean, to pay for all this new expansion.
Which is one of the reasons why this ends up looking more like Japan. We are spending money on things that will not solve problems. We are spending money on things that will not cause there to be a recovery in the economy.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com.
We've talked about this before, Kevin, but 1921, 1922, what it took to enter recovery in the midst of a depression, a very overlooked depression at that, was cutting government expenditure by 50%.
And keeping your hands off of everything else.
And letting the market do what it does best.
And that was the quickest recovery of any depression in the 20th century.
That's exactly right. Instead, we're doing the exact opposite, which is what Roosevelt did 10 years later and took a depression and defined it and made it a Great Depression by extending it an extra 10 years.
Yes, but David, we live in a different day and age. We've got to have cap and trade to try to keep things green, don't we?
So, Kevin, what you mentioned in cap and trade is just one of the areas of taxation being proposed by the current administration. Taxation. We know that in 2010, 11, and 12, the rich will be fleeced.
Well, and the rich, let's put that in quotations. Anybody who runs a business who has a reasonable income.
Essentially the productive class in America. Now, the promise of a protected lower and middle class where they will not see tax increases, that will be absolutely true in 2010. He will keep his promise in 2010, mm-hmm. because we need your votes in 2010.
Absolutely.
However, there may be a necessity to break that promise in 2011 and 2012.
Yeah, but don't those taxes and don't those cap and trade show up in other areas that still affect the pocketbook of the guy who is just trying to make a living?
Right, so not applied to income tax, but cap and trade. Cap and trade, Obama has said in recent months, this quote-unquote, under my plan of cap and trade systems, electricity rates would necessarily skyrocket.
Necessarily skyrocket. So we're talking about the poor and the middle class. I guess it doesn't matter because they don't use electricity.
Well, so we don't have an increase in taxation for the poor and middle class, the lower and middle class. But what we do have is all of the unintended consequences of bad policy measures. This, again, is where policy and politics feeds back in a negative loop back into the economy and back into the financial system with very negative consequences. What's interesting, Kevin, is this. If electricity rates are skyrocketing, who is the knight on the white horse coming in to save the lower classes from that financial pressure? Is it the current administration? Of course. So they come in and they solve a problem that they created. But again, they are the savior.
They'll blame something else so that it keeps the focus off of it.
Exactly. It's a problem they created, but they can shift that blame.
David, can you explain why that the electricity prices would skyrocket or energy prices would skyrocket? Do we have an example of how that would work?
Well, if you take the energy, let's talk about the price of gasoline. You know, under the cap and trade tax scheme, Valero, which is one of the top refineries in the U.S., this last year, if you looked at their carbon emissions and everything else, under the cap and trade scheme, they would have to pay $6 billion from 2009 out of operating profits to cover their cap and trade commitment.
$6 billion out of how much in the way of operating profit?
Their total operating profits were $7
billion. Oh my. So we're talking about $6 billion out of $7 billion would go towards the greening of America. But I mean, is this to have an effect? Is this something that actually works?
Well, at a certain point, Valero says we can't function this way. We're a marginal business, a very thin margin business to begin with. And if in a banner year we can keep $1 billion out of seven, but six gets passed on to emerging markets and those who would be the recipients of this money on the other side as we exchange our right to pollute. Listen, Kevin, all that does is take the price of gasoline and put it at $5, $6, $7, $8 a gallon. So again, the unintended consequences of policies, this is where the rubber meets the road. The unintended consequences of policies wherein is the Obama administration trying to raise the price of gasoline to $8 a gallon? Maybe they are. I would like to think they're not quite that stupid.
Maybe 8% of them understand that this isn't going to work, but those are the ones with past business experience.
So 92% think this is brilliant. And maybe this is how we stimulate the economy, the green side of the economy, and everybody goes out and buys a smart car because we can't afford to buy a gallon of gas and keep our gas guzzlers going anyways.
But it does keep the EPA happy. I mean, what's the EPA say about cap and trade?
No! The EPA says this does nothing to diminish pollution. It does nothing at all. All this is an exchange mechanism. You get to exchange your rights to pollute. What they're basically saying is there's a total amount of pollution which is going to occur. We don't want it to increase, but if we can say this is what's going to occur, then you have a right to pollute and you can buy a greater right or sell off your rights, and then guess who's in the middle?
It's a little bit like coming up for money for your sins.
Wait just a minute though. There's someone in the middle. There's a middleman who is trading these credits. Who's trading these credits? I would encourage any of our listeners to go to Google and look at who owns the trading companies for the cap and trade.
For the cap and trade. Well, can you name them?
No, but I do think this is a very inconvenient truth. So in addition, Kevin, we've got the trading tax, which is being proposed for Wall Street. And this would be absolute carnage for the New York Stock Exchange, the American Exchange, and total volumes in our marketplace.
Well, explain what the trading tax is.
Well, it's been described as a very small tax, which will bring a very large amount of money into the federal coffers.
There's no contradiction there. It's a small tax, but it brings in a large amount of money.
And here's the problem, Kevin. 70% of New York Stock Exchange volume is high-frequency trading. These are transactions which are trying to profit on one penny, one nickel, no more. I mean, you're talking about razor-thin profits, but you take a $1 million portfolio and turn it over 250 times, 300 times, 500 times in a year. Mm-hmm. You're in and out of the market, maybe even many times in a given day.
And what they're talking about is taxing every one of those transactions.
Right, to the point where the penny earned is the penny given away. There is no room for trading profits in that environment. I'm not saying that I'm a fan of the fact that New York Stock Exchange volume is dominated by high-frequency trading. All I'm saying is that if you penalize the high-frequency trading, 70% of current volume, all you're going to do is force it into foreign markets. You're going to take that 70% and it'll go to the London Stock Exchange. It'll go to Shanghai. It'll go to Japan.
Somewhere that's not transaction traded in the United States.
Exactly. So again, the unintended consequences of policy decisions come back around and bite us right on the behind. And it's not nice.
Well, when does the madness stop on this? I mean, none of these things are making any sense at all.
Well, in that context, you'd have Wall Street and broad as a virtual ghost town, and money would begin to move in mass out of the markets and out of the U.S. And this is what's interesting. That brings about a greater likelihood of exchange controls, even though the capital flight was caused by D.C. policy.
Right. It's caused, but the money's leaving because it has to. Otherwise, it doesn't survive, and then they put controls on it. It's an endless loop.
It's an endless loop.
When does the endless loop stop?
When we throw 535 guys and gals out on their ear. When we fire them all. When we put in term limitations and say, this should be citizen statesmen running our country, not professional career politicians. That's when the madness stops, Kevin. But even amongst conservatives, there's not the will for it. Not the will for it. When will there be the will to throw all of the rascals out, even the good ones, for the sake of getting all the bad ones out?
We're probably going to find an awful lot about the elections and the nature of the way people are voting this year. 2010 is a political year, so it'll be interesting to see. But David, before we run out of time, I do want to move to the geopolitical, because we've started with the financial and economic, we moved to the political, but what are the geopolitical concerns for 2010 that we'll be focusing on?
There's a couple things, Kevin. We'll spend quite a bit of time this year talking about China. We'll spend quite a bit of time talking about Pakistan and Afghanistan. We'll spend quite a bit of time talking about Iran and Israel. We'll spend quite a bit of time talking about Russia. So again, as I started the program saying, it's going to be difficult to be concise. There's a lot to cover in 2010, and this look ahead today is just a preview of coming attractions. Lastly, Kevin, I think we'll also spend some time this year and today in this program looking at social unrest as a part of that international and geopolitical concerns. So with China, going back to China, Kevin, the question is the economic boom sustainable? China's taking over the world, but this is the issue. That's the kind of language that we heard in the 1980s.
Sure,
Japan.
With Japan.
And so I think it is important to realize that they may emerge. and they submerge. It just depends on what happens in their banking system.
Well, their GDP is growing right now at a very strong rate as far as what's being reported. Isn't it close to 8%?
Yeah, between 8 and 9% GDP growth in the context of economic chaos. This is for 2009, which would include a significant drop in consumption from Western Europe and the United States. Now, here's what's interesting, Kevin. This is one of the reasons why we've always encouraged our listeners to think about numbers, to listen to them, but also to call them into question.
Question them.
So you've got GDP growth, which is an indication of the economy expanding,
8 to 9%,
and yet electricity consumption in China was flat to down for the year. How do you have an expanding economy with electricity consumption dropping? There is an incongruity. There is something that's not right about the 8 to 9% number. And all I can say is we have no way of verifying the 8 to 9% GDP growth number, and I think it stinks.
Well, you know, but you have to admit, there has been momentum over the last, 20, 25, 30 years. China has moved from a country that we barely ever talked about to one of the larger economies in the world. I mean, where does it stand right now?
2009 was an unbelievable year for China as it upset Japan as the number two largest economy. In the last 20 years, it's gone from number 10 to number 2. And Goldman Sachs, Jim O'Neill over at Goldman, their analyst has said that by 2027, they will exceed the U.S. In terms of being number one, which means right now we are four times greater in size. Our economy is. We're either going to have to take two steps backwards, they take a step forward, bringing us, relatively speaking, closer together, or their growth explosion is just going to be huge.
David, you just recently brought up, too, that 2009 was the year that there were more automobiles purchased in China than there were in America. So in some ways, we really are starting to see China as an emerging superpower, are we not?
We are. My issue, Kevin, comes back to two things. One, their demographics are awful. By 2030, their family policy will have absolutely destroyed the country.
And the family policy is the one child
per couple policy. They're getting old before they got rich, and that's basically the problem. They don't have enough in savings individually to float their retirement or to float their retired class, and they don't have enough of a worker base. You'd think with 1.3 billion people, surely they have this huge working base. But in fact, they have caused this problem. They could this year, right now, change their family policy, and they have 20 years between now and 2030 to populate their culture, get rid of their family policy, and they solve the demographic problem.
But up to this point, unless they do that, it's just going to be a nation of old people, old, right. Poor people.
Old, poor manufacturing people. At what point do you want to not work in the factory? Is it at 75? Is it at 85? Is it age 95? At what point can you not show up? The greater issue for me, Kevin, is that you've got bank loans estimated at 40 to 60% non-performing in China. And the only reason that doesn't matter is because it's truly not a free market. You have banks which are controlled and dominated by the government. You realize that total insolvency here in the U.S. with a bank is between 10 and 15% non-performing loans.
But you're talking about almost half in China.
Right. Yeah, because that, on a leveraged basis, that means that there is no bank capital at 10 to 15% here in the U.S. I don't know what the bank multiplier is in China, but I do know that 40 to 60% is too much to remain solvent. It doesn't matter because it's a controlled economy. But ultimately, Kevin, it does matter because even Japan had some form of a controlled economy, and their bad bank loans ultimately kept them in a depression for 19 years.
Well, David, we paper over things just by printing money here in America until we can't anymore. I mean, will they paper over it with the yuan?
Well, they might not have to. The excess of U.S. treasuries, perhaps they can paper it over with treasuries.
Hmm.
I think, Kevin, that the appreciating yuan is one of the things that there's a lot of political and geopolitical pressure to see. And the reason they won't let their yuan appreciate is because that takes them out of the export game.
Like we talked about with Europe as well.
Exactly, exactly.
All right, now I'm going to shift gears here because Pakistan has been a country that we've been hearing an awful lot about. Is 2010 going to be a Pakistan-focused year? And what should we watch for to see how that's going to play out?
Even more than Afghanistan, because it's thought that most of Al-Qaeda is sitting in Pakistan to begin with and not Afghanistan. And I think one of the issues to keep in mind too, Kevin, this is a whole regional issue. India is front and center when you think about Pakistan and Afghanistan. The old conflicts between Pakistan and Afghanistan, how easy would it be to incite the old feelings of hatred between Pakistan and India by Al-Qaeda slipping in and starting sort of terrorist activities within India.
Well, and let's face it, there's far more division between India and Pakistan, as far as that dividing line goes, and Afghanistan and Pakistan. Well, as we talked to Bernard Lewis, I mean, that's a line that was drawn by the West.
Yeah, arbitrarily. Yeah. That's absolutely right, Kevin. And, you know, we've actually adopted what we call the AFPAC policy, which is the Afghanistan-Pakistan policy.
Looking at them as a single unit.
As a single theater. So Pakistan remains a wild card in 2010, probably one of the most important ones, a nuclear state with political instability, and the Osama and clan being there and Afghanistan, that is definitely a wild card for political stability and certainly could be one of those things that takes the price of gold and doubles it within a six-week period, not unlike what we saw with the Russians invading Afghanistan. That region is very, very tense. That region is very, very tense, and the implications are enormous.
Well, speaking of wild cards, in fact, maybe it's not even a wild card because a wild card can be a surprise, but somebody's holding an ace on this Iran-Israel situation. What do you think will happen? Do you think anything will happen between Iran and Israel in 2010?
There really is no clear winner or loser between Iran and Israel. But regardless of the outcome, there is someone holding an ace up their sleeve, and it's Russia. Russia gets to see the U.S. embroiled and the world with their attention committed to the Middle East, particularly as tensions raise between Iran and Israel. And the question is, how are they benefiting?
They're enjoying the attention right now, aren't they, as far as our need for them to stay strong on Iran?
Well, and more than that, they're also appreciating the fact that our attention is elsewhere, allowing them to consolidate those relationships. And we talked about this last year with George Friedman. They're consolidating the energy-dependent relationships both in Eastern and Western Europe.
Yeah, Germany depends 50% on Russian oil.
And the implications for that are interesting, Kevin, because what they're basically doing is undoing the foundations of NATO. And all of this is happening. We can't do anything about it. Our troop commitments in the Middle East are exhaustive. We've put all in. We've put all in the Middle East, and we can't do anything in Eastern Europe. We can't do anything in the Balkans. We can't do anything anywhere else.
It's like having chess pieces that are pinned all over the board that can't really move.
And they're ineffective as a result.
Yeah.
So the Iran-Israel thing is interesting in its own right. But it's also interesting because it's allowing Russia and China to reinforce their old relationships and also for Russia to expand its control and monopoly in terms of an energy monopoly.
Well, and David, talking about the ties between Russia and China, I read just recently that over the last 5 years, Russia and Chinese trade has grown 500%. So obviously, there's much more of an alliance there economically. You would have to assume that politically it'd be there as well.
Right. Now, the issue with Iran and Israel, obviously we've had the Obama administration move away from the normally supportive posture that the U.S. foreign policy has had for the state of Israel. But Russia and China have now, as a part of the U.N. Security Council, stepped up in support of Iranian sanctions, which kind of gums up what Israel can or would do because they actually have global consensus, global support, in a way, for them, implicit in the sanctions for Iran. This is where it gets tricky. Israel can't necessarily do anything in terms of a first strike unless or until China or Russia back away from that support or commitment to the UN sanctions. Israel would be acting sort of out of line with the rest of the world. Does Netanyahu, does the Knesset, does the political body have the will to do that? If it came to survival, yes. And that would be, you know, a defined imminent threat.
Sure, we've seen that in the past. But unless survival is at issue, we're probably not going to see anything then.
And here's what's interesting. I would, on the face of it, say this is a done deal, that there is going to be a first strike. Israel will hit Iran at some point in 2010. The problem is, and we discussed this in recent conversations, you and I, Kevin, everyone thinks that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And when everyone thinks that something is going to happen, it usually doesn't happen.
It usually means something else is going on that we may be missing.
Right. And it's almost as if we're playing into a certain context and the perception has been created. The crisis and the attention has been pointed in a certain direction. Look at here, look here, look here, look here. Meanwhile, over there, something even more critical is happening and we're not paying attention to it.
Well, and David, I don't want to diminish the Iran-Israel situation to a distraction that's being used. But one of the things we've talked about in the past, and it's been brought out when in any type of control economy, when you have the potential of social unrest because people can't meet their bills, they can't eat, what have you, if you create an enemy Even Naomi Wolf talked about this. Insider outside. If you create an enemy that everyone has to unite against, that social unrest can be put to a side, you know, for a season. Explain the situation that we're in right now worldwide with social unrest, because people are getting hungry.
Right. Well, that's absolutely true. And just a final thought on Iran and Israel. We will bring on many guests this next year from the Israeli Knesset and other experts on the Middle East to unpack what is actually happening.
From the inside out.
From the inside out. Kevin, to your point on social unrest, the issues are pretty clear here. Income disparity is the worst in history. Mm-hmm. So the divide between the super rich and the poor has never been greater. The International Labor Organization expects that there'll be 200 million workers moving back into a $2 a day living standard in 2010. You know, they also expect that 60 million more in 2010 compared to 2008 numbers will enter complete and total unemployment.
So will there be a political reaction to that? I mean, how will the politicians respond?
Well, and you know, if you look at the G2, if you look at the G3, the G7, the G8, the G20, any conglomeration of these countries that are getting together to try to solve the world's economic problems, given the reason why all of these organizations end up being ineffectual, they may come up with great ideas. The problem is, as economic ministers, they are appointed to those roles. They are not the politicians who are elected. So when they go home from Davos, when they go home from wherever they're meeting around the world,
they're not facing a voting constituency.
They're not.
Right.
And ultimately, politics trumps economics when they get back. So I think, Kevin, the political reaction is going to be telling in 2010. Unemployment typically continues to rise even after a recovery begins. And we would argue that we are not seeing a global economic recovery. We're seeing certain numbers put out there, whether it's the Chinese numbers, if you want to believe 8 to 9% GDP growth, great. If you want to believe U.S. GDP growth positive for 2009, be my guest. But income tax rolls are off 10 to 12%. Sales tax are off 8 to 12%, depending on the state you're in. The underlying numbers don't support GDP growth. In other words, we have a whole world that is assuming one thing, while in fact the very opposite is happening.
And disappointment's worse than the first shock.
Right. And I think actually this is where social unrest comes into play, because today you have widespread complacency. What we're likely to see in 2010 is an emotional whipsaw, where we assumed that the government had the answers. We assumed that spending trillions to right the system was working. And in fact, when it doesn't, what's the response? I think you're looking at panic, and I think you're looking at anger. And those are two things. You know, Admiral Dennis Blair, before the U.S. Senate, noted that global political instability triggered by the economic crisis was, in fact, America's primary near-term security concern. That was America's primary near-term.
And you can just translate that around the world.
Well, yeah. The heads of the IMF and the UN have seconded that more on a global basis, and the EIU has looked at social unrest as a near certainty in 77 out of 166 countries under assessment. So, you know, if you're looking at Africa, if you're looking at certain parts of Asia, if you're looking at certain parts of Europe, I mean, listen, you had the Icelandic government tossed out. It was basically, you failed, you're out, somebody next, please.
Yeah, and Iceland was a great example of having inflation and unemployment continuing at the same time. You had a depression and you had inflation, and we've talked about that before. Talk about social unrest. You may not have enough money to buy that bowl of rice, but what if that bowl of rice then costs 3 or 4 or 5 times? It becomes an impossibility.
Right, and that's when you begin to see people riot. That's when you begin to see people vote with pitchforks and torches.
And isn't that when social unrest occurs? I mean, most people don't just go out and say, well, I'm going to go riot today. Even though I've got 3 good meals and things are going fine, I'm going to riot. What happens is a man becomes faced with an impossibility,
right,
whatever it is, to feed his family, whatever. But when faced with an impossibility, that seems to be the only response. At that point, though, it just compounds on itself, does it not?
It does. And Kevin, I mean, we saw that in Argentina going back decades, the Juan and Eva Perón era, a very charismatic couple who came in and spent money like drunken sailors and lived a very extravagant, I mean, literally the equivalent today of trillions of dollars they were pouring into the Argentine economy.
But and she granted, was so glamorous and in the news, you know, hobnobbing with movie stars and the Evita complex, basically.
Right. And I sometimes wonder if we don't have a bit of that in the White House today. Glamorous young couple, creative ideas, a lot of energy. I wonder if we aren't, in fact, spending ourselves into oblivion. And just like Argentina of the 50s and 60s, what followed a tremendous, tremendous hardship, will we have that in the United States? I think that's likely. Again, Kevin, what precedes social unrest is widespread complacency and the assumption that government and geopolitical bodies have solved the world's problems when in fact they haven't, which means that expectations have never been higher. And there's a problem with expectations, Kevin. When expectations go unmet, that is when real grief, that is when real anger and angst begin to be obvious in the marketplace. So, Kevin, for 2010, the economic concerns, whether they be the government bond crisis, the direction of gold, you know, the risk appetite, which we think people will learn something, a very severe lesson in 2010 and 11, these are issues economic in nature will continue to explore. The political concerns, certainly, we have the census ahead of us, we have the midterm election. As we've noted in recent shows, it's very important that people get involved politically. Whether you're Republican, a Democrat, an independent, make your voice heard. Make your voice heard, because what we're seeing now is government, which is supposed to be representative of the people, is representative of special interests only. And so unless you're out there making your voice known, our representative form of government is and will continue to be an utter failure. And so we have political concerns. Taxation is something that we'll continue to explore as we see things change in 2010, and particularly 11 and 12, where we're likely to see even more draconian decisions made. Last but not least, we'll continue to explore in 2010 the international and the geopolitical implications of what happens here on our own soil nationally, and the decisions made by independent politicians all over the globe.
Well, we'll be looking forward to listening throughout 2010. And David, I'm looking forward to some of the guests that you've already started thinking about lining up. That's our commitment to our listeners. You had talked about complacency is one of the worst enemies when we get into a period of time like this. Listening to this program and staying informed with various newsletters and other forms of information breaks the complacency. And that's what we'd like to encourage our listeners to do on a weekly basis with us.
Don, at the beginning of every one of his presentations growing up, used to define complacency as self-satisfaction coupled by an actual unawareness of dangers or deficiencies. And that's what we're trying to break, is the awareness of dangers and deficiencies. We want that to be in the forefront of our investors' and clients' minds as they make decisions. We want to make sure that complacency is utterly broken.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.